What's your relationship to yearning and the future now?
I was actually happened to be revisiting that idea because it begins the most recent book. And I think part of my hesitancy is, for me, what poetry kind of gave me a way to do was to update and reassess and reattune to the ways in which yearning has been very prominent in my life, both in ways that I'm celebrate in ways that I'm afraid of. And so with the first book, Revising the Storm, the major figure in that book is my father's addiction. So that was the primary topic around yearning when I started as a writer. And for a lot of years, I just thought my relationship to yearning was a one-way sort of resistance effort to be mindful and cautious. You know, that as a child of an addict, something my mother always sort of warned about was, she said it so many different ways, but this idea that you might inherit a sort of addiction gene or a sensitivity to becoming one who's addicted to various things. And so I really use and thought poetry was a way to just stiff arm, resoundingly and at every different, you know, level and form, an idea of yearning or the possibility of yearning to get out of control. And then through writing those poems, I think what I walked away from with the first book was a more variety of moves, like a way to both get traction on yearnings that I didn't want having presence in my life, but then also to celebrate the ways in which yearning draws us together. Yearning is a way to honor what the meaning of distance might be to a person or to a body or to a voice. Or to an idea or an emotion. So again, I because that journey started from a place that I thought I was very, very wrong-headedly thought that I knew what I needed to do with yearning, and walked away with far more questions and attention to the ways in which it keeps evolving. And so I'm more committed to that idea of now, like that question of now is so precise. And yet that's the thing that keeps me from saying, well, here's what it is. It continues to be a question for me.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, speaking with Jeffrey Davis about his collection of poetry, Night Angler. Don't go away. So that question is in reference to the first poem of the collection, The Fidelity of Water, in which you write, "Used to be no future in yearning. Feel how far you've come." And Jeffrey, when I sat with your collection, I was so aware of how embodied the work feels. I mean, even the choice to make the word feel rather than see how far you've come. I was wondering, how do you exist in a way that is in your body? Like, what, like, how do you navigate that space of being, you know, in an intellectual space and really in an embodied space?
Yeah, like my first instinct is to play with the question a little bit, which is to say, like, we're never not in bodies. Even when we're being super heady, but the irony and sometimes tragic irony when you move in circles that consider themselves intellectual is somehow like the body. There's an effort to sit the body somewhere else or to check the body at the door. And for me, like one of the biggest places that's really important to push against is when I'm teaching, especially teaching art and especially teaching poetry, although any art probably lends itself to this. We're often reading things that evoke a very bodily reaction. Not every poem will do that for everybody, but and sometimes when you don't allow the body to be a part of the conversation, what's ineffable, what's beyond the rhetoric of academia, for example, which sometimes can lean towards, you know, headiness and intellectualism. That can put students in crisis. I've seen students will be reading a poem that's moving them And if they don't have permission to identify that movement as being in their body, they can be put in a kind of crisis. They can be confused. And I've seen students get really frustrated. And something over the years that I've learned is acknowledging and also offering my own bodily reactions. Like sometimes even poems I've read hundreds of times, the first reaction is just a sigh. And that's a part of, and that's the beginning of the conversation, you know, and that's also intellectual. But I have very distinct memories of being in that crisis as a student, especially in grad school, having very bodily reactions to intellectual conversations and thinking that there was something wrong, that I wasn't doing it right. You know, I'm first generation college student, and grad student only seemed like I was in water that had a coast further and further away that I didn't know which direction to swim towards. I guess what I'm saying is, as a student, I didn't know how to invite or request that the bodiedness of certain conversations was allowed. Like I didn't know how to ask for permission to make that more prominent a part of the conversation. But places like living room couches and bars with friends, like I felt like that's where I began to learn how to at least recognize when that was happening and honor how important the embodiedness of what we're doing is. I mean, sometimes in workshops, that was very different, I found, which is, I think, why I steered eventually away from the lit crit side, although I finished my PhD in that field and more towards the creative writing field.
Right. Will you take us into the collection and read The Night Angler?
Sure. The only thing that you need to know about this poem is that a streamer is a kind of lure used in fly fishing that's supposed to imitate that something actively swimming or moving through the water column. This is The Night Angler. A headlamp guides me through October cornfields, along the slender crossties of bridges. Bulky in waders, I sidestep thick briar, patches of poison ivy all the way to the river's edge, where I kill the lamp, and soon the moon's blue albedo is enough to enter water with dreamfish prowling the currents. I begin casting toward the far, cloaked bank, all ear, all fixed on the grim swish of my streamer threshing back and forth, a mad bat parting night air. In time, I will lead my own boy into the precision of this contraction inside the throat, this animal alarum in the dark. When my first cast conjures nothing, no monster trout panicking the line, I slide further into the river's cold, send more barbed asking through deep shadow. I labor long to lure a sudden swallow, the wilderness of hunger pulsing on the other end of these hands. This poem comes up a lot in my teaching. It was one of the first poems that I found the courage as a teacher when I was, it's the first poem I wrote between Revising the Storm and this collection, or the first one that I was aware was going to be in this collection. In part, I showed it to a mentor who announced it as such, Robin Becker, who's a great mentor of mine. I showed her this draft of this poem, and she immediately was attuned to the ways in which this was a new body of work that was developing. But I showed a bunch of students various drafts in this poem. I'm an incessant revisionist. And so I showed all the stages or select stages of this poem. All of them would have been too much. And when I often talk about revision and my ear or my sense of when a poem is either working or has done something that will mean I'm holding on to the poem or my attention is sort of held, is a turn, and that turn is often located somewhere very bodily for me. There were many drafts before my son appeared, and as soon as he appeared in the poem, I was like, oh, you know, that sort of turn in imagination was really crucial in my faith in this poem sticking around.
You know, I was reading your collection again during a time when I was attending to Christian Cooper's experience in Central Park as a birder, and I was thinking about Drew Lanham's book, The Home Place, who writes about being a naturalist and a birder. And if you're comfortable, I'd I want to know what it's like for you to be an angler, which I consider, you know, as a woman who's an angler, it's I find it to be a sort of a bro bra whitewashed sport or an old timey Hemingway sport. And what's it been like for you? How do you negotiate those spaces?
Yeah, it's great. Great question. I mean, so I actually teach a course on angling and literature and culture, and this comes up a lot. And there must be a better way. Like I'm rethinking the narrative of the course, the emotional narrative in particular, because we start with some of the quote unquote canonical angling tics. So, Hemingway, but we start with Isaac Walton's A Complete Angler. We do Norman MacLean's Riverruns Through It, and different excerpts. And it's not long before a student will raise their hand and kind of say, I mean, they smell bullshit, rightfully so. And,
right.
and we talk, and then it's right. Like, yes, let's talk about that. And we have really great, uncomfortable conversations that start, or they're necessarily, I think, grounded in that discomfort. Because often the class makeup is more diverse than the body of literature that if you just stayed around, I think accurately, what the culture claims that it's about. Or the voices that tend to get the most traction around this field or this experience, it's very suspect and very non-inclusive, and I found in creating this course that I've had to ask, and now that the feelers are out, though, so many people send me books and pieces, and so I've been able to add a lot more diverse perspectives. I mean, I did in the first iteration, but that's continued to expand. And then we do read and we realize how different the lens, depending on what body you're in, the lens of your experience, what you're afraid of. You know, it's not so much bears, it's people now. And so those kinds of things come to the foreground, and it's a really exciting sort of course for me to teach. And because it has so many parallels with my own personal experience, and I've been thinking about this and working on some personal lyric essay type writing about being an angler and living. So, I grew up fishing in Pacific Northwest, salmon, steelhead, and some trout, and then did grad work. Went to undergrad at Oregon State, and fished. That's probably the least I fished in my life was when I was in undergrad. Although I did fish some of the Oregon streams, and then came to Pennsylvania and really converted to fly angling. Met a really close friend, and he sort of showed me how much further I could go by the comfort of his presence with me. He happens to be a white man. But moving to Arkansas was really kind of challenged me to revise my claim on this, what I've described and continue to describe as like one of the most important rituals of my life. I get so much from being on the water, but when I go to what one of the pieces of water I fish the most around here is the White River, which is near Cotter and Mountain Home, Arkansas. It's like central north Arkansas. I drive through a state or a town called Harrison, which has gotten some infamy for its proximity to white supremacy. And there's been various billboards put up that claim that imagination roams in that area, which is, of course, microcosm for the nation. But it's very shocking to be headed towards the most important ritual, the most healthy ritual of my life, while going through these rhetorics that are announcing the potential danger and trying to compromise, my claim to that experience or my claim to that place. But, I've dug more into Harrison, and there's also a voice and imagination there that's actively trying to resist that message, and they're trying to amplify how inclusive they want that place to be considered. So it's an embroiled place, just like sometimes it can be embroiled for me, embodied. But when I was working on this piece, all of a sudden I had this rush of memories of my father when I was young. One of the places we lived for a short while was a town called Onalaska, and then Centralia, Washington after that. And they're both really rural areas. And like most places, Montana has this too. Getting access to water, whether you have private, public access, it's a touchy subject. It can be hard, it can be difficult to get access to water that you really want to be on. And I didn't think anything of it growing up watching him drive up to, you know, the doors in these rural places and knock on people's doors and ask for permission to walk through their land, walk through their property. I mean, to be able to gain access to a stream. And then, you know, but suddenly when I'm here thinking about how like the kind of model, and he really didn't have any explicit conversations about how this was racially coded, and, you know, and the risk. He wanted to fish, and he went up and knocked on the door and was like, the first thing they're going to say is no. And there was a lot of really confused, you know, faces. And only through, you know, looking back now, I can kind of understand more of the context of what exactly was transpiring and the model of assuming your safety until proven otherwise was kind of my father's way. And yeah, it's tough. Like, my wife, she worries a lot about me going out. It's and she's also in a similar bind where she knows how important it is for the water to be present in my life. And I mean, we fish together too, so it's not that it's only solo, but solo fishing for me is a particular thing that I rely on. And it's a strange kind of ritual of saying goodbye and hello. It's safety is always a part of the conversation. Be safe, call me, you know. And she's not worried about me drowning. She's worried about who I might run into.
In staying with the water theme, in the prose poem Self-Portrait with Headwaters, there were two pieces that really stood out to me. And the first comes in the fourth section, and you write, "I do, however, love the glamour of an eddy, its unresolved meander, its agile queering of the current's dumb flow." And I, my breath caught when I read that, and I was hoping you could just speak to that sentiment or that line or that image.
Yeah, like poetry, I think streams, they continue to offer me chances to open up the abilities of my imagination, rather than which something maybe like the work week or even the year, the calendar year, assumes or invites me to assume that there's a kind of linearity to things. And even a river would seem to have a kind of linearity to it. And you know, of course, the water flows in one direction in a stream. But the longer you stay on a river, and even the same river, the more you return to a river, you know, if there's a change in season, if there's a change in weather, if there's a change in what someone's doing upstream and even downstream, you learn to see the error of reading things too linearly. I mean, even my love for the river, I've been challenged to open up that and benefited from that. And I was very stubborn about this. Like, I kind of, and throughout my life, I've had these chapters of, you know, I only want this kind of fishing, this kind of conditions, and I need this much time. And of course, life changes, and you have to evolve your rituals around that. And so I think this moment is me trying to honor and bless the ways in which I continue to catch myself thinking a one way thought when it's anything but.
Uh huh. The second part of this piece, which struck me, is when you write, "Time and time again, I perform this ceremony, part memory, part prayer, and against what light remains, it occurs to me. I don't understand the why of my craving to locate the corridors through which the right water passes, to make contact less impossible between bodies otherwise drifting apart." I don't know that I've ever heard angling made so like devastatingly like heartfelt. Like, I was like, oh God, that's it. Why do we do this?
Yeah.
Why do we like amble through like blackberry bushes and risk moose crossings?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. I had this day, in fact, I'm wearing an ankle brace right now because I went and fished day before yesterday, and you know, one of the differences too in fishing Arkansas is they have cotton mouths in the system. So it's a threat that I didn't grow up knowing how to identify. And so I don't trust my ability. And so it pulls at my attention. And yet, like, there are certain things that continue to drive me forward. And so I there was this stream. So I put in at one place where a creek enters, and I wanted to fish up about 5 miles to where this other creek dumped in. And I just wasn't fishing because I didn't know the river well enough. I wasn't fishing at a pace that really saved enough time for me to make it back. And it kept creeping up closer and closer to when I should turn back. And I just kept going. You know, I was just so stubborn. I wanted to see the water where this creek dumped in. And I had to go I was losing daylight and just walking as fast as I could, you know, on banks and in the middle of a river back to my vehicle, and just thinking like, what have I done? You know, I'm looking around for snakes and I'm moving, I'm rolling my ankle. And I definitely had some more stronger, like, what are you doing? But honestly, when I'm fishing, to kind of like circle back a little bit to the embodiedness of it, I very, very, very rarely ever write on the river in the way we think about writing, a sort of a line or language that might make it to the page. Is, I mean, I only consider one time where I wrote on the river, and it's the long piece in the middle of this book, where that was crafted in the experience. It's a piece called Like a River. But other than that, like, it's written, I'm thinking about this now because of your great questions, but I'm thinking about how the embodiment part is written. And then when I'm home or I'm in a different space, you know, in crafting, I'm able to read the embodied experience and give language to the embodied experience, or study the embodied experience. And even, you know, come away with something that translates or attunes to the bodied experience. And so moments like this are like, I have faith that I'm there for moments like this. I feel what's happening and I'm reading my body and I'm trying to be present with that embodiment, and the writing and the translating of it will or won't come later. And luckily in a moment like this, and I really appreciate your resonating with this, because it proves that I'm not alone in this possibility.
No. Right. I'm glad you brought up Like a River. For our listeners' sake, it's another prose piece which seems to cover a fraught pilgrimage. And there's a relationship between a speaker and the you. And you write, "You are dragging a fly rod and the weary otherness of your brown body through rural America. No one slows to identify your pain. Fool." And I was like, can you speak to the fool here, and that voice? Like, you've mentioned this voice that sort of comes in and says, like, what are you doing? Or, you know, what are the competing characters here?
Yeah, this is a bizarre piece for me to talk about, because of how differently it came about, and the way that I've only read this aloud twice. Once was with the community that was there with me when this experience happened, and when I was working on this, who saw me before and then saw me after. And so in a sort of honoring that community and to let them know that I was okay, I read this for them towards the end of that residency. And then again, I read it just this last year at a gallery reading that was about Black experience and Black lives. And I wasn't planning to, and I just did. And the audience there also kind of waded through it with me and were very, very lovely and warm in their patience. Because I'm just realizing as I'm looking at it here on the page that it's not an easy piece to talk about because of how it came about. And so the way that I have described it, though, is this is probably the most intimate conversation I've ever experienced with my own loneliness. And I didn't realize it until midway through the process, because like anybody who has their own care in mind, I kept wanting to pulvel out of this conversation. For one, it's not why I was there. I was there to fish. I don't ride in the river. I'm like, I kept trying to, you know, stall the conversation, and I kept trying to refocus my attention on getting to the water and to experience, you know, my love of fishing and what it offers me in terms of peace and a kind of attentiveness. And so the second person, you, is just kind of how the conversation unfolded and I don't know if I have anything smart to say about it beyond that, but there was this kind of this fool. Every time I had a smart idea that I thought was going to break the spell of this kind of reckoning, it was unrelenting. It was an unrelenting sort of confrontation of, I mean, in retrospect, I think the irony of it being the most intimate, I guess it was the most intimate to date, because Revising the Storm felt so intimate. It felt like I was being really courageous and finding different ways to kind of admit to a loneliness. But I think after that experience on the water, I think what I was introduced to is the ways in which we're all susceptible to quietly or loudly convincing ourselves that we're smarter than our loneliness. And in my experience, that's just not true.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Jeffrey Davis about his collection of poetry, Night Angler. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. Jeffrey, when I saw you read at the Montana Book Festival last year, I was really struck by your ability to hold pain, real human pain, you know, not just elegy or symbolism or metaphors of pain. But you cover some personal sacred ground. And I wanted to hear you read a poem. And I also wanted you to be able to talk about your instincts in being able to write toward that kind of material.
So something that I often, when I'm in conversation with writers or in, you know, a sort of responsibility seat in terms of mentoring a writer who's coming after me, when this topic seems to kind of wander, and inevitably it does, I always feel beholden and I feel an urgency to denounce a myth that we have that we haven't vetted or we haven't challenged enough or a kind of a permission or a contract maybe. But this idea of the tortured artist is one that I think is really risky. And I think we're all complicit in it. We've had too many artist heroes not make it to the natural end of their being with us. And I don't know how to break that spell. I just hope to contribute to the collective breaking of that spell. And so I always challenge other artists and myself to write, you know, I don't know if we can say yes or no to the, I guess you can say yes or no to anything, but I've decided not to say no to the poems that take me to places of pain. But what I promise to any reader and to myself, and the promise that I ask for in return, is I promise to come back and share what's happened to my voice and to my hands on the other end of that. I promise not to let that journey toward an existing pain compromise my continuing to be with you. Like that's not what I'm after. But that wasn't always true. When I first started writing, I think I was really after something that would validate without altering the reality of a pain that I didn't know how to be on top of, a kind of abandonment that I didn't know the meaning of. And every time I tried to connect my father's abandonment to the meaning of my life, that was a really risky equation. And it was only through finding other voices and artists that showed me that you can have that pain, but it doesn't have to compromise your being here. And so I hope that, you know, implicitly or explicitly comes through in the work, that was the kind of, what's the word I want to use, conviction that I developed over the years, that I can fit my pain, like I can fit pain in my mouth that I don't have to spit out things like joy or wonder or my, you know, or breath, and or that's the last thing that I want to do.
I was hoping that you would read Prayer with Miscarriage, Grant Us the Ruined Grounds.
Prayer with Miscarriage. Dear boy, it is true. You took two tries to get here. for your mother and me to calyx together a body bold enough to carry the grace of you. Amen. So forgive us if we still bow inside the garden of your miscarried becoming. Grant us the ruined grounds of the first prayer, fiercer than our cleaved breathing. How could we rush to rinse the word loss from our deparented mouths? Remember this. We surrendered a new name for everything to the tender hour at our chest. Nothing blooms in the old field of maybe. No sound flowers above, please. But we endure what's not delivered from the impressions planted by our knees. Amen.
Your the use of amen. What's your relationship to that word and that sound?
Yeah. So I'm thinking about my son in particular. I've been thinking a lot about that because you know, as a parent, religion and, you know, our structures of faith and belief and prayer come up. And so the same rural place that we ended up living when I was about my son's age now, so I was eight or so when we moved out of the urban area in the South Puget Sound and into some rural areas. Another thing that happened at that time was my father began a string of rehab programs, and those tend to be, or the ones that he enrolled in, were faith-based, in Christianity in particular. And I remember so vividly how profound it was to feel that there was this other greater presence that had control of things. Because, you know, even as a child, it was clear, despite my mother in particular, her everything she was doing to hold our family and our safety together, that to say that she had control of the situation would have, you know, would, I don't think I could say something further from the truth. And so as children, you know, you pick up on things that are unsaid, you know, tones and spirits that are of how, of the real drama or tragedies that are playing on. But this idea of God and the ways in which Christianity was presented to me was so comforting. It was unbelievably comforting to have faith and to have this sight to, you know, or this path to redemption, this feeling that my father was going to make it, that he was being healed. And so I that's the core or that's the foundation of my language of faith, and it's never really left me, although, you know, over time I fell away from the church when I was early or a teenager is kind of when I had to part for personal reasons. But I think about this as a parent, because I want my son to have faith. I want him to be I want him converted to something that he believes in that's that profound. Or at least I think I want that. I don't know yet that I shouldn't want that for him, I guess, is probably more accurate. And so I think that's why that's one way for me to invite him into a language of faith and a frame of belief is through poems. Like, that's the thing that I continue to have faith in.
I'll just be transparent. I'm already aware that we're going to need to do like a radio edit and an extended edit for podcast of this. So this is how I'm imagining that we can end the radio edit is if you would be so kind as to read Poem in Which My Son Wakes Crying.
Poem in Which My Son Wakes Crying. When there is no exit wound, his life matters. When there is only the dream wound, his life matters. When I still run with all my panic against his hurt sound, his life matters. When I wrap his fingers non-wound in the undivided dark, his life matters. when he has been soothed and I lay him back inside the casket of sleep, his life matters. When I still linger to watch him rest with all my worry against his calm, his life matters. When he rises with and into and as if the easy miracle morning, his life matters. When he smiles bright like no more fires need setting, his life matters. When he asks to have the bandage removed, his life matters. When my hands shake too much, his life matters.
Whew. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And Jeffrey, if I were to be really bold, I would ask how you felt about reading Self-Portrait as a Dead Black Boy, with the intention of it being on a longer version of this recording. It's totally up to you.
Yeah, I'm very much willing to read that poem.
Okay. If I can, I want to frame it because I you know, in doing my homework, I found you reading online on YouTube, and I watched a video in which you're reading at the McLeod Plantation in Charleston, South Carolina.
Yeah.
Which, you know, they call a series in which African-American poets reclaim the plantation landscape by exploring the past, present, future, and the imagined in their own voices. And you read this poem, Self-Portrait, as a Dead Black Boy. And it was transportive to watch you. And I really wanted to know what it was actually like for you to be in that space. And I would invite you to read that poem here as well.
Yeah. It was, I don't know if I have the words. I think, so there are things that happened leading up to the reading. One, I was in the community visiting with the people from that area. And then I had just gone on one of the tours for the grounds. And the way that they framed the tour, at least the tour that I participated in, it's all through story. And intentionally, they don't take you into what they call the big house. And the perspective is all through the enslaved people who spent time there. And so it was a really, I kept having to kind of step back from the tour a little bit, just a little bit out of earshot. And in part, I didn't want to distract from people's connection to the place and to the story, and also like realizing that I've been thinking a lot about audience with that. Like I don't think I was the primary audience for the stories, right? They were trying to jar an imagination that I didn't need jarring. But I mean, I definitely wanted the stories, and I was trying to stay present and embodied, and having a very difficult time because of how moving they were, and then the reading. If you look, see from the video, the reading is outside, which the entire tour takes place outside, and there's a bunch of, you know, these you're reading. I mean, you can't see what I can see, but at least I don't. I mean, if you go online, you can probably see, but I'm looking at an audience that's, you know, diverse but mostly white, and the right behind them is the row of cabins that, you know, the people lived in, and some of them continue to live in up until recent time, and then off to the right, you have what they call the witness tree, and it's this really giant tree that has, you know, huge limbs have fallen off, and then behind me you have an open field that is, they have a small plot of cotton that still grows there, but it's where the cotton would have been grown. And so every place that I was sort of, my eyes would rest had a very intense and yet slightly different emotional resonance. And so there was nowhere to really rest. And I think that was one of the things that made that experience like the arena that I was reading in, there was nowhere to go to be less embodied. And I mean, in most readings, like that's what I hope happens for me to be present with the poems and to be, you know, to be like the embodiment. If a poem is going well for me, it can't avoid its embodiment. But because of the events leading up to them, I was having a really tough time honoring my commitment that we spoke about earlier, which is to stay on top of this, to not be in crisis. And so that was a very unique kind of arena to be reading in, and have an instinct to kind of find a place to rest a little bit, to get my breath back, and failing to do so and kind of being like, well, and then looking into the audience, I think that's the place that I finally rested, because they were there with me. They were, I could see in their eyes, and I usually really have a hard time doing that. Like, I usually can't read an audience because I'm trying so hard to be present with the poems. But there, the audience, and this has happened on a few occasions too, that when I'm struggling to be on top of something, that the audience will kind of vocalize and be like, we're here with you. And that's the grace.
Wow. I'd love to hear this poem in your voice.
Okay. Self-portrait as a dead black boy. 1. At 13, for a whole dark season, I was lethal with my pellet gun, murdering minor things that wandered into yard, stalking the thin woods between our house and the highway. I picked off any bird, squirrel, rabbit, snake I could track. If I had 2 surprise seconds to explain the meaning of my hands, my instincts would have been to show you the weapon, to turn, hoping you could see gentleness poised behind the risk. So when Tamir Rice was shot X times, the toy pistol he carried couldn't have killed anything, big or small, even if he tried. But of course, as the story goes, that math's all wrong. 2. The law among my friends growing up, whose ever car had the best sound, assuming they wasn't in trouble with their mama, drove. We rode the wheels off of TT's grandma's burgundy hoopty because of how the bass from its speakers trembled the tips of our hair and slapped our young bodies alive with a beat. So when Jordan Davis was shot X times, his legs and lungs and aorta pierced, a citizen who hated the rattle that black folks can make when they make it out the house, all around, America's trespass music fell. Even now, a different mood than mine hits my ears like rain. 3. I made it to 28 without owning a gun. And then my son burst onto the scene with thousands of miles between me and my tribe. So I learned it took just hours to return, loaded and licensed, to conceal a new danger. However, as soon as I felt that dark weight tucked against my torso, I realized the mistake. How few and unsafe the scenarios with me pointing this threat at another threat to survive. So now, on my knees, I'm preparing my heart to receive the next shots until a new divinity forbids one more black body be burned down according to an imagination that feeds its godliness with fear as seen through smoke. 4. In my 30s now, I buy sneakers that don't slip off my feet and feel older for the fit. On the way home from getting new pairs, we stop at a local farmer's market. And before exiting the vehicle, my boy and I change into our fresh kicks to feel godly while walking aisles of shining produce and handcrafted candles. So when Philando Castile was shot X times, a bullet searing through each year of his little girl's life in the back seat, I can't see his shoes in the documentary of this dying, but his body slides in and out of his safety belt as cop keeps weapon trained, a dark star stopping the open question of his window. 5. Sometimes a sleeplessness blesses you. In our shared family bed, I lie awake and hear the steady sonata of my wife and son's unconscious breath, turning our room into this shore with the midnight tidal music I wouldn't want to live without. So when Eric Garner was denied air for X seconds, the song and kin of his lungs flattened above the city's dirty sidewalk, let us pray. 6. On occasion, I weep while watching the living brown X of my hand move across the page, swift and controlled and sometimes remaining perfectly still. So I've written this poem out in longhand, in the best cursive I can manage, under light that bends into something soft enough to call healthy, none of which can keep me alive, no matter the grace.
Is there anything else, Jeffrey, that you want us to know about these poems or anything?
I've been thinking a lot about, I mean, this is the first interview I've done, first public thing I've done in several months now. And you know, wondering and about what the risks and the necessity of speaking after moments when you don't know what to say, risking adding a sound, when there's such a diversity of really intense despair and hope seems a really difficult, fragile thing. I haven't been reading and writing hardly, you know, at all. And needing to be honest about the ways in which I've found myself with new kinds of silences in my life. But also trying to connect that with reasons why I don't feel hopeless. And part of that is, I think, similar to my need of the ritual of fishing, is that need to go there is always about coming back and seeing how my attention has changed, my breathing has changed, my groundedness has changed. And to honor that transformation, to honor the possibility of being newly attuned to where I'm on, like the ground I'm on every other day of the year that I'm not on a river. And for me, like, poetry is the same thing. And I talk about this at length or whenever I get a chance with writers, to hope and push for that I'm working on the kind of poems that will change who I am in the world, that will open up things that I didn't know that I wanted to do or things I didn't know that I wanted to stop doing. And sometimes those moments, I think as writers, when you fall in love, I think to be a writer, you kind of have to fall in love with language and working on language and crafting language. And then sometimes when that crafting halts, it can be really scary. But sometimes, not every time, I can't speak for everybody, and even for myself exclusively. But sometimes that's when that work of testing the ground that you're on and how your ear has been changed. Like, sometimes it's because you have listening to do. Sometimes it's because you have living to do. You have proximity to mine, and that the attention that a poem takes needs to kind of hold off to be on the other side of this radical needing to be present in what we're witnessing. And so I'm trying to learn how to honor these new silences and not name them something prematurely like despair. And on the flip side, like, not be too overly hopeful, you know, like I don't know where I am in that continuum of despair and hope. But I, I feel like compelled to be honest that I'm working on that, and that work hasn't come in the form of writing yet. And I'm learning to honor that and not be afraid of that.
It's comforting to hear for me too, you know, that this is such big stuff and it's a lot to hold.
Yeah, I mean, we have a radical new listening on its way. I choose to believe that, you know, and I don't know how it's going to manifest, but I think we to usher in a new imagination takes a kind of attention, or demands a kind of attention that won't be broken, and that's not always something we're ready to give, and not everybody's ready to give it at the same time. But I hold on to listening to what's on the other side of this.
Jeffrey Davis was raised in the Pacific Northwest and now lives in Arkansas with his family. He's the award-winning author of Night Angler and Revising the Storm. Look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.